Hi, everyone, and welcome. This is Seek Sustainable Japan. I'm JJ Walsh in Hiroshima, Japan, and today we have a very special guest all the way from the UK, Michael Mears. Thank you so much for joining today.
Great pleasure to be with you, Joy.
Now, Michael, you've been working on an amazing play, and you're coming to Japan, including Hiroshima, and it's a Hiroshima-inspired play called The Mistake.
That's right, yeah. Well, it's about what happened in Hiroshima in 1945, but also the play takes in the events leading up to that terrible day, the building of the bomb, you know, before that, the discovery of the chain reaction, and the play switches between continents and countries, switches from Europe to America, then across to Japan, and it also switches back and forth in time as well. So, you know, it switches from 1940, well, it switches from early 1920s to early 1930s, but it also takes in 1945, and then also flips forward to modern times. Yeah. So it's a bit of a roller coaster journey for the audience, but I think that so far it seems to have absolutely kept audiences on the edge of their seats. That's what they've told us.
That's awesome. It sounds like you originally developed it in 2022 for the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. Is that right?
Yeah, well, that's when it was premiered. But actually, when did I get the idea for the play? I got the idea for the play about 23 years ago. There was an article in one of the UK newspapers, The Guardian, on Hiroshima Day, August 6th of 2002. And on one side of the paper, there was a big interview with the pilot of the plane, Paul Tibbets, pilot of the Enola Gay that dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. Really good interview, in depth, with excellent American, quite well known in America, oral historian called Studs Terkel. And then on the other side was an interview with a survivor of the Nagasaki bombing, a woman who was a young woman at the time, a teenager, survived the bomb and grew up to become a poet and an artist. So there was a very moving interview with her. And I looked at these two interviews and I thought, these two people have never met. I mean, the pilot, you know, at that time when I was reading the interview, you know, in his late 80s, I think, had clearly never met a hibakusha and had no desire to. And I just had the idea then, wouldn't this make a fascinating drama where the elderly pilot met somehow or other, I wasn't sure how, met a survivor of the atomic bomb, or a descendant of a survivor of the atomic bomb, and then just go from there. So that was the very seed, that was the very first seed of the idea for the play. And anyone that writes will tell you, you know, people say to you, how long does it take to write a play? How long is a piece of string? It's hard to put a figure on it, but, you know, I'd put it away, bring it out, put it away, bring it out over the years, and then start adding more to it. But initially it was just going to be two characters. As I say, a female descendant. I wanted it to be a female descendant of a survivor of the bomb and the elderly pilot. But then as time went on, I thought, I've got to add the science in. Now, everyone's heard of Oppenheimer. Very famous, you know, he was the scientific director of the Manhattan Project. There's now been this big movie about him, which we might talk about, my feelings about the movie, and a lot of people's feelings about the movie. And clearly he was an essential part of getting the bomb built and dropped. But I thought everyone knows about him. But then I came across this other scientist. There were many extraordinary scientists on the Manhattan Project, and a lot of them had come from Europe, had escaped the Nazis. You know, they were emigres to the US, and brilliant scientists, physicists, nuclear physicists. And the name that came up in my reading was Leo Szilard, who was a Hungarian Jewish nuclear physicist who initially went to Berlin in the early 1920s, left Hungary, went to Berlin to study physics, and met Einstein there, Albert Einstein, and actually became very good friends with Einstein. Einstein was about 20 years older than him, sort of. Einstein became his mentor, as well as a lifelong friend. And as time went on and the Nazis began to get power in Germany and things were clearly looking very dangerous, Leo left Berlin and went to London in the 30s, where he actually came up with the idea of the nuclear chain reaction. While walking in a London street, he tells the story, and we relate the story in the play, of how it came to him. Very simple concept in a way, but no one had quite thought it was possible, but he did think it was possible in order to tap into the energy locked into the atom, to release it. And initially his passion was that this would be a great source of energy, you know, and would mean that we wouldn't need oil or coal anymore. That atomic power would help help the whole globe, really, in terms of, you know, producing the energy that we needed to survive. He hadn't thought of how it could be used for a bomb, not yet. So anyway, I thought this scientist struck me as really interesting because also, well, I'm sort of sketching in the story, but once he realized that Germany might be onto these discoveries as well, and once he realized this, of course, could be used to create a bomb, his sole intention, along with many of the other scientists from Europe, was to build a bomb before Hitler did. Not necessarily to use it on Germany, but to have it before Hitler did. And that was his real sort of sole motive in working on the project. So then, when in 1945 the Nazis were defeated, Germany was defeated, he thought, well, he was shocked to learn that now the US was going to use it on Japan. He had only ever worked on the project with such passion in order to defeat the Nazis. And he felt there was no moral justification for using it on Japan. So from that point onwards, only a few months before the atom bomb was actually dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, he did all he could to try and prevent that happening. Now, you know, it's one man against the US government and the US military, but he did what he could. Whereas Oppenheimer, you know, carried out the mission right down to the wire. So the fact that Leo Szilard went on this roller coaster journey of being for the bomb and then flipping around and being against the bomb. And then, of course, when the bomb was used on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, after that point, Szilard, you know, devastated by that news, then spent the rest of his life, which was about 20 years, predominantly doing what he could to promote world peace, to promote international arms controls agreements. You know, he worked to try and control the monster that he'd helped create, as he says in the play. That's a rather long answer, I think, to your question, Joy.
No, that's fantastic. You really described the character of the scientist so well. Can you tell us a little bit about the pilot, a little bit more about the pilot character?
Yeah, so the pilot, Paul Tibbets, was a superb military man. You know, he was in charge of the mission to deliver the bomb. So he worked very closely with Oppenheimer and with Leslie Groves, who was the military director of the Manhattan Project, played by Matt Damon in the movie, I think, General Leslie Groves. Tibbets' role, because Tibbets was a very experienced pilot from the very beginning of the Second World War. He was only 29 when he was given the mission to drop the bomb on prepare to deliver and drop the atomic bomb. And it was a top secret mission, obviously, but he had to assemble the crews, the navigators, the bombardiers, et cetera, et cetera. But he was in charge of it, and he knew he was going to fly the first mission. He didn't fly the mission to Nagasaki, but he was still in control of everything there. He was a superb military man in the sense that he carried out his mission. He was obsessive. You know, he probably was working 16, 17-hour days, you know, checking the B-29, refining it as a plane that could carry a very heavy bomb, 4.5 tons bomb, that distance, and then deliver it. And then, you know, the plane would have to do this extraordinary maneuver to escape the blast. A very difficult maneuver for a bomber plane to carry out. So he had to practice that again and again and again, because, you know, he wanted to bring the crew back safe and sound. They weren't going to be martyrs. And the thing is, there are very good interviews with him on YouTube, and there's one in particular that I've used a lot in my research. And, you know, he comes across as a very genial, affable, you know, decent man. But he expresses no regret about what he did. And some people get confused, or maybe they read the wrong interview or whatever that says, oh no, didn't he have a breakdown or something, or didn't he? No, he did not. There was another member of one of the crews that I think had an alcohol problem and tried to create a bit of self-publicity and so on. But Paul Tibbetts, colonel as he was then, general as he became, never expressed any regret or remorse. You know, he felt, and a lot of Americans, you know, absolutely would back him up, that the bomb had to be dropped to end the war and to prevent the invasion of Japan, which would have, he says, it's a widely held belief, would have cost another 500,000 American and indeed Japanese soldiers' lives if the invasion had gone ahead. So Tibbetts really felt he was bringing, but you know, this was an important thing to do, to bring the war to the end. But he never allowed himself, you know, as a military man, to think about the consequences on those on the ground. You know, if you're in the army, you don't think about those things. You sort of get that drummed out of you. So we gather. So I've found him very, I wanted him to be in the play because I'm fascinated by people who have such a clear line on something that won't budge, won't shift. And so dramatically in the play, I wanted to have a modern Japanese woman, descendant of a survivor, who challenges him and, you know, tries to break through that sort of veneer, tries to break through the sense of denial, you know, that he's in denial about what actually happened on the ground. Interestingly, both he and Szilard feature for a few minutes in the Oppenheimer film, which lasts 3 hours. And of course, the film is about Oppenheimer. So in my play, I wrote my play long before the film was ever thought of, I think. Revenge is probably the wrong word, but in my play, Leo Szilard is the main character and Oppenheimer appears for about 30 seconds.
played by me. That's amazing. Can you tell us about the woman character that features in your play?
Yeah, so this was essential for me. I always knew that I wanted, because I'm male, I wanted someone to be complete opposite. So I wanted it to be a female Japanese younger performer. So Riko Nakazono, who is playing the part in Japan and who played it in New York and has played it recently in the UK, was born in Osaka, and Japanese is her first language, but she's an amazing English speaker as well. So she plays the role of Shigeko, who is a young woman, about 21 years old, in Hiroshima, on the morning of the blast, gone to work in her factory, and the factory is severely damaged, but she's sort of buried under rubble, but she's alive. And she gets out, or she's rescued and gets out, and then starts a desperate search for her family in the city, as so many people did. And, you know, one of the main complaints about the Oppenheimer film is, whatever you may think its merits are, it doesn't reference the Japanese experience at all. And I know the director of that film, Christopher Fulford, has said, well, no, it's a film about Oppenheimer. It's not about Hiroshima. Sure. But what Oppenheimer did, the most significant achievement in his life, was the creation and delivery of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So I don't see how you can really truly ignore that. So for me, it was, well, you know, lay my cards on the table. I'm a lifelong pacifist. Although my father fought in the Second World War, my grandfather fought in the First World War. So I don't think pacifism is a gene. But I've always opposed nuclear weapons from a very early age. So for me, it was crucial that the play put the Japanese experience front and center. So the play dovetails the experiences of Leo Szilard and the pilot and Shigeko on the ground, which I also feel is dramatically interesting for an audience as well, to sort of, so it's not just a terribly sad and distressing story about an atomic bomb survivor that keeps being stopped, and then we pull back to look at the science again, you know, one of the crucial scientific experiments that led to the bomb that's caused this terrible suffering. So, and I think Riko, when she first read the script, she said that was one of the things that really impressed her, was that it wasn't just a long litany of suffering. That's hard for an audience to take. And she didn't know anything about Leo Szilard. You know, as a Japanese person, she didn't know anything about Leo Szilard, and knew very little about the pilot. So she felt those were the sort of the merits of the play, that it explored those interesting angles as well. But Riko's role, so as well as playing Shigeko Nomura, she plays a descendant of an atomic bomb survivor as a modern Japanese woman. And the pilot in the play, as an older man, is sort of on a book tour promoting his book. Now, this all really happened in the sense that when I was beginning to write the play, you know, 20 plus years ago, I noticed that he was still alive. He was coming to the UK on a book tour. And I thought, I've got to go and see him. It was about 40 miles north of London. So I was going to go and see him and, you know, get him to sign my copy of the book afterwards and try and talk to him and say, you know, would it be possible to have 15 minutes with you, General? Because I'm trying to write this drama. So that was the plan. And then he cancelled the tour. He got ill and cancelled the tour and subsequently died. So I never got to meet him. So again, that was a sort of stimulus for a couple of scenes in the play where he's on the book tour. I try to imagine what would have happened if, well, in the play, not if I'd gone to the book tour to hear him speak, but say, what if a descendant of a Hibakusha in the UK went to the book tour and, you know, put her hand up and ask questions. Very polite at first, but then asking more and more challenging, more and more difficult questions, putting him on the spot, you know, in front of an audience. So that's how that developed, as I say, from my frustration of not actually being able to meet the pilot all those years ago, because sadly, you know, he got ill and died. So the Japanese element in the play is crucial. And, you know, the character of Shigeko pretty much starts the play and certainly ends the play, as well as being involved in a lot of the sections in the middle. In Japan, where we're coming shortly in September, we've chosen to do it in a bilingual version. So Riko, the amazingly talented Riko Nakazono, is going to play the role of Shigeko 1945 in Japanese. Which, of course, is her first language, but nevertheless, she's been performing it in English, so she's had to relearn, which she's got about 10 days to relearn, because we did it in English last weekend in the UK. So she's got about 10 days to relearn that role. The rest of her part, the scenes with me, will still be in English. However, there are a couple of short scenes in the play where I briefly play her fiancé. Of course, I'm completely the wrong age, the wrong type, etc. But this is the magic of theatre, two people playing all the roles. And I've decided to take on the challenge of playing those two scenes in Japanese. The fiancé has about 15 lines. I've been working hard on them, and Riko is a good coach. Yeah, there we are. Rico is a good coach, very good coach, and I'm hoping I will get there. So yes,
I know that you've done roles with accents. Is this the first time you'll be doing it in another language?
I've done bits of it. So my mother was Italian. I've done bits of Italian in one or two roles, but no, and a bit of French, a very small bit of French in a TV thing years ago. But no, you're right. This would be the first, and I think so, the first time on stage. Yes. Yeah. So it's quite a challenge, actually. Yeah.
Well, that's exciting. Yeah. It's exciting for both of you because she's also used to doing her performance in English. So it'll be a switch back to her native tongue, right?
Yeah. And she actually said the other day, she said, so it's been translated by a wonderful Japanese man who translates for the theatres, won awards and so on, Yojiro Ichikawa. And she said, you know, reading the Japanese version of her role as Shigeko, which she's been playing in English, she found it really affected her deeply and profoundly, even more than the English version. Somehow, because of the English version being her second language, it's not that she was detached from it, but it was just that little bit removed. Whereas speaking it in Japanese, she thought, whew, this really is, this is serious stuff. So we're very excited about doing it. And you know, sir titles in Tokyo to help audiences if they're English or Japanese. Also down in Tottori City, where we're at Bird Theatre Festival, that they'll be doing sir titles. And then we go to Hiroshima itself. And I don't think we've got sir titles there. So we're providing dual translation scripts, dual translation synopses. And we're just hoping that the power of the play will carry along people anyway. Another aspect of the play, which we're very excited about, is the staging of it. So this is small scale theatre. This is not National Theatre of Great Britain. This is small scale touring theatre. But we spent a lot of time coming up with a small number of carefully chosen props and set items to enhance the visual telling of the story. And we use those not just in the way the object would be used, but we use them in more inventive and imaginative ways. So for example, as the pilot, you know, I have a sort of walking stick aid, which also at one point becomes a sort of stick on which we put a model of the B-29 plane early on in the play. Yeah, there's the model plane, and we put it on that stick. And then that walking aid stick, at another point, becomes a shovel. It also becomes part of the cockpit, part of the steering mechanism, joystick in the plane. And audiences really enjoy this because it's such a serious story. We wanted to make it visually appealing, maybe the wrong word, but engaging perhaps is the right word. Visually engaging. So while they're witnessing this, you know, very serious story, there's almost a sort of playfulness in the way we present it with these objects. We tried to create the nuclear pile at the University of Chicago in 1942 for the famous experiment where the chain reaction first was proven to work. And that then led to the bomb being able to be created. So we create that with just sort of four or five objects that we already have on the stage. And this blackboard, which you've shown in those photographs, which is very important, and we move that around. That's the one thing we can't transport to Japan, so we're sourcing blackboards in Japan. And very interestingly, the blackboards in Japan aren't as tall as the ones in the UK. I'm trying to think of a reason for that. I mean, I'm 6'2".
If you're tall, you also have to duck your head as you're walking through doorways. So That might be the same reason.
Thanks for that advice. But we have, well, anyway, we've chosen one, and it's not as tall as the one we have in the UK, but we will still be able to work our magic with it. We use the blackboard in a few different ways. One way in particular, which I'm not going to give away, because audiences go, oh, wow, when that moment happens, I don't want to give it away. So come and see the play. And then you too can probably go, oh, wow. Yeah, so that was a very important element as well, as I say. And when we first, so another very long answer to your lovely question. Thank you. So 2022 was when we first performed the play. Yeah, 2022 at the Edinburgh Festival. Following year, we performed it in London for a couple of weeks where it was sold out. And then I worked hard to organize a UK tour. We went to about 28 venues for one night each, or two nights occasionally, sort of small art centers, small theaters, and a lot of non-theater spaces as well, a couple of churches, some Quaker meeting houses, four or five schools, school halls, which was great. We really enjoyed doing the play in non-theater spaces as well as theater spaces. We wanted to sort of not be hemmed in by, oh, it has to be in a theater. So, for example, in Hiroshima, we'll be in a hall in Hiroshima International House, which does have a small stage, but no fixed seating. So we'll arrange seating around the stage, probably in semicircles. Can I talk a little bit about Hiroshima?
Yes, please.
So people say to me, oh, you've been to Hiroshima, haven't you, obviously? I say, no. I feel I've lived there for a number of years through all my research and reading.
Amazing, because can we talk a little bit about your other play, The Priest's Tale, which of course is very connected to Hiroshima as well. Maybe can you tell us a little bit about that as well? Yeah.
I can link that with what I was going to mention about. Yeah. So I also have a one-man monologue, 1 hour long, The Priest's Tale, this is adapted. I didn't write it originally, but I've adapted it from John Hersey's extraordinary book, Hiroshima, where he interviews, well, in 1946, he came to Hiroshima and interviewed six survivors, five Japanese and one German Jesuit priest who was based in the mission house in Hiroshima. During lockdown, let's hope we don't have another one of those. In 2020 was when we were due to premiere The Mistake at Edinburgh. Lockdown came, so that was postponed along with most of the world's other activities. And stuck at home as Hiroshima Day approached, I just felt I wanted to offer something. And this venue in East London where we filmed a performance not so long ago, from which the trailer is drawn, they said, well, you could come in, obviously there'd be no audience, you could come in and do a live stream, because they do live streams, this venue in East London, to quite a captive audience they've built up. And I said, yeah, I want to adapt this 1 hour, it'll be about an hour, piece from John Hersey's book. Because I looked at John Hersey's book and I thought, well, there's no way I'm going to play a Japanese survivor. But I thought, German, I can play German. You know, I was brought up a Catholic and I'm European. So, and actually I studied German for 5 years as well at school. So I thought, yeah, I think I'm qualified to play that role. So I looked at John Hersey's book and it's all in third person. It's a brilliant book, short book. I think it should be compulsory reading for all politicians and leaders of nuclear armed states. So I took the story of the priest, sort of took it out and edited it and changed it into first person. So it'd be the priest telling his story. And we filmed that and I learned it and we filmed it straight down the lens and it was live streamed. But we also had a wonderful Japanese violinist, Chihiro Ono, who is based in London. And she performed musical interludes through the piece every so often, short musical interludes. which were rather wonderful and added something to the piece. So yeah, Father Wilhelm was a priest, Jesuit priest. He was about 38 at the time the bomb dropped. He was based along with some other priests in the mission house at Hiroshima, and there was a Jesuit novitiate about 3 miles from the center. And if you go online and sort of put in the Jesuit priests of Hiroshima in 1945, various sites will come up talking about the miracle of their survival. Putting this down maybe, you know, to its divine intervention, you know, it's God looking after the priests. The reason why their mission house survived the initial blast while all the other buildings round about collapsed was slightly more prosaic. The one of the priests, I think, who'd been there previously, was very nervous about earthquakes in Japan, in Tokyo. And he'd urged that the building should be double braced or triple braced even. So it was. So when the bomb went off, their building was so securely braced that it didn't initially collapse. I mean, there was plenty of damage, but that's why the priest survived with sort of injuries, you know, from cut glass and so on, while all the other buildings round about immediately collapsed. You know, they were just far enough away from the hypercenter as well that they weren't completely obliterated. So they were able to get out and escape. And of course, fires were beginning to catch all around. And they made their way to Asano Park. Well, they were going to one place where there were just too many fires, Eastern Parade Ground. Couldn't get across that bridge because there was terrible fire on the other side of the bridge. So they went in another direction to Asano Park, where there were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people flooding in into the park, looking for refuge, you know, severely injured, wounded, dying. And the priests, this Jesuit priest, Father Wilhelm, and the other priest, well, two of the other priests were quite badly injured, but Father Wilhelm certainly, and the Reverend Tanimoto, who's also in John Hersey's book, who was a Methodist minister and who knew them, and who also is an extraordinary, was an extraordinary personage. his daughter's still alive, I think, in Hiroshima, Koko Kondo. They did all they could to help in any way they could, you know, the sick and injured around them. They went back into town once the fires had sort of subsided in their area, and they got rice out from their air raid shelters, and got the Reverend Tanimoto got utensils, brought them back to the park. He organized a sort of cooking rota with the women who weren't too injured. And so they fed rice to a number of people. And yeah, I was very inspired by Father Wilhelm's story. And so I was very motivated to turn it into this piece. And I've done it a few times since. I've done it maybe 10 or 15 times since. So I did it straight down the lens in lockdown with this Japanese violinist. And then last year, 2024, when I was mainly planning all the touring for this year, for the UK and for the US and Japan, we went to the US earlier this year. I thought, I want to bring out the priest tale again. And what happened was, yes, there was an event in London in the middle of last year, organized by Quakers and CND in London, to welcome two atomic bomb survivors from Peace Boat Japan, Peace Boat that goes around the world with atomic bomb survivors and, you know, pulls up in various ports and goes and gives talks. They go and give talks. And so I was asked, would I do a short extract from The Mistake? After the two atomic bomb survivors had spoken. And I said, Rico is away that day. She can't do it. I said, but I could do a piece from this other piece I have, The Priest's Tale, which they were aware of. I said, that's fine, just do 20 minutes. So I edited down a short version and went along to this event. And these two atomic bomb survivors, an elderly woman and an elderly man, the woman was Toshiko Tanaka, who still lives in Hiroshima. she was 86. She was six at the time the bomb was dropped. And the gentleman, forgive me, sir, I just temporarily forgotten your name, but he was a baby in Nagasaki at the time of the bomb, and his family took him back into the city looking for relatives. So he became affected by radiation. They each spoke with a translator, very movingly, about their experiences of the bomb. She'd lost, you know, family, school friends. She'd been injured herself, suffered burns and so on, and had had health issues all her life. But here she was, beautiful, lovely, gentle presence, but speaking passionately against nuclear weapons, that they should never be used again. And then they took questions from the floor. And then it was going to be me. And I suddenly felt this, I thought, we've just heard two actual atomic bomb survivors speaking. How can I get up, an actor, and just enact 20 minutes of a German atomic bomb survivor, a priest? You know, I'm just an actor. But then I banished that thought, and I thought, no, just do it, Michael, just do it. Do what you've prepared. And so I did. And it was very, very generously received by everyone, but by the two atomic bomb survivors, and particularly Toshiko. She was very moved and was thanking me for my dramatic art. And then I told her about, oh, we're coming to Japan next year. She said, oh, you must come and visit me in my house in Hiroshima, which is what we're going to do. And we're going to perform The Mistake for her and others in Hiroshima. So the other thing I'm going to do when I'm in Hiroshima, we're only there for 3 days, there's a lot to do, performances plus visiting the museum, of course, the Peace Park, is I'm going to go and try and find Father Wilhelm of the priest house, find his grave, because he's buried, I think, in the grounds of the noviciate, about 3 miles from the center. And that would just be so amazing to see his very simple grave and pay my respects.
You should also, of course, visit the church.
Yes.
Which has been rebuilt, but they still have a lot of things linking to the original building, information about the Jesuit priests and their story. It's a very impactful place. It's worth visiting as well.
Yeah, no, I should be sure to do that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. A thing that really impressed me about Toshiko Tanaka, so it was seeing her reaction to the priest, that made me think, that was what made me think, I want to revive that, the whole play, and I want to get it out of the chair and make it more dramatic, have movement and staging, which is what we did. So it's now, you know, very animated and dramatic piece, which it's maybe not as substantial as The Mistake, but it still is very powerful and moving. And he's a very affecting character, if I can call him a character. Of course, he was a real person, but very human and full of foibles and eccentricities, and but with a real heart. And what I loved particularly about him, and found so fascinating in the story in John Hirst's book, was the fact that he became a Japanese citizen. He became a naturalized Japanese citizen. He went through the process of naturalization. And, you know, he learned the language, and he wore Japanese clothes at time. He really immersed himself in the culture he was in. He didn't remain an outsider, a foreigner. He really immersed himself. And I found that very inspiring. That's a real message for us all, you know, that we're all linked, we're all connected. And, you know, when in Rome, do as the Romans do, that old saying. You know, when he was in Japan, he did as the Japanese did. But seeing Toshiko, I just found so inspiring, because I learned that she had welcomed into her Hiroshima home in the last few years many people, but including the grandson of President Truman, the grandson of the president who ordered the dropping of the atomic bomb on her city, and welcomed him in a spirit of forgiveness and peace and reconciliation. I just found that so inspiring. And she also welcomed at another time the grandson of one of the crew of the Enola Gay, not the pilot, not Paul Tibbetts' grandson, but one of the other crew members. And again, I found that very humbling to read about that, to hear about that. You know, she seems to me to be the embodiment of peace and reconciliation and holding out the hand of, you know, we can't keep being at war with each other. We have to talk to each other. So she continues to inspire me to keep doing this work.
That's fantastic. I just had the chance to meet Ari Beezer, who's the grandson of one of the pilots who actually was on the Nagasaki and Hiroshima flight. He might be the grandson that she had met. He's been Ari Beezer, and he's been to Hiroshima many times. He's written amazing articles. He wrote a wonderful book, Nuclear Family, also documenting Hibakusha survivors' stories. And he has a new book that's just coming out in Japanese, and we're hoping in English too sometime, with the granddaughter of a dual survivor, who her grandfather survived both Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs. So the book is about being above and below the mushroom cloud, which is amazing. Yeah.
Wow. What was her name again?
I'll have to look it up. Yeah, sure. But if you search Ari Beezer, there's a lot of news. The book has just been published, so that's coming out soon. Wow. Just to give you a little break, maybe you can drink some water, and I'll introduce a little about your play. Sure. So The Mistake is coming to Tokyo and Tottori and Hiroshima, and the dates are on the screen now. Also, The Mistake has had wonderful reviews from The Times. The Past Comes Alive, a gripping piece of storytelling. The UK Theatre Web, this production received one of very few standing ovations I've ever seen at the Edinburgh Fringe, a dramatic treat. So wonderful, really fantastic reviews. People are receiving the play very well. That must be wonderful after spending so much time creating the play, Michael, to have those reviews and that response from the audience must be.
Yeah, I mean, creating the play and also a huge amount of admin involved in, you know, setting up these tours and trying to find the money to pay my collaborators. I'll say it. I'm completely unpaid on this project. It's a what I call a passion project, a heart project. So I've made the choice throughout to be unpaid in terms of salary. Some of my expenses are covered, you know, flights and so on. But all my collaborators are paid. But it's sort of been. It is very gratifying, the response of audiences. Some people have said to me, because we were in New York off Broadway for 3 weeks earlier this year, which was amazing. Some of my friends said, oh, that's going to be a great career opportunity, isn't it, Michael? You know, there might be film producers coming. And I said to them, I hope it'll be a career opportunity for Rico, who's half my age and is very talented. And I hope, you know, she'll be picked up to do more great work. But I said, no, for me, it's... you know, I've been around a bit now, and I don't see it as a career opportunity. It's you know, it's peace activism, in a very, I hope, subtle way. I should just stress the play is political, but with a small p, not a big p. You know, really worked hard to give everyone a chance to put their point of view passionately and strongly, especially the pilot. You know, there are no villains in the piece. It's whatever one thinks, yeah, you know, the atomic bomb, appalling, should never have been used and should never be used again. But the history around it and the events leading up to it, so complex, you know, it's not black and white. So many people have so many different strong opinions about whether it should have been used, why it should have been used, yes, it had to be used, and so on. I try to at least give a sense of that in the play. But no, so for me, one of the wonderful things about doing the play, as well as the audience's response, is meeting a number of extraordinary peace activists. So obviously there's Toshiko, who I've mentioned earlier, but then when we were in New York, we were in New York quite by chance for the same 3 weeks, 2 or 3 weeks that the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty was being discussed, the next stage of it, at the United Nations. So I mentioned this to CND UK, Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, who are very supportive of my work, and I'm a member of their organization and so on. And they said, oh, that's great. You know, we'll try and let, I said, are you sending any delegates? He said, we're hoping to, but we'll certainly put the word out, you know, that you're doing the play at the same time on this important, very related subject matter. And then in the end, they couldn't send a delegate because to do with costs and various other things, commitment time. So they said, you know, would you like a pass to the United Nations sessions so that you could go along, not necessarily represent, well, sort of representing us, but just so you can plug in there and listen to what's going on. I said, that'd be amazing. I said, obviously I'll be doing the show in the evening and I'll be quite tired possibly, but no, I'll get along some of the time. So they got me a pass into the UN, and I've been to New York once before, but it hadn't occurred to me as a tourist, oh, must visit the United Nations. It just hadn't occurred to me. I was doing the Museum of Modern Art and all that kind of stuff. So it was amazing this time to actually have access to most of the areas in the UN, certainly where this conference was taking place. And I went along 5 days. And the actual conference itself, where all the different countries had a representative and they were all discussing in fine detail the treaty, wording of the treaty, in order that it would satisfy every nation to sign it and so on. Very legalistic. You know, I popped my head in a couple of times into those sessions and I thought, my goodness, it's dull. Oh, it's so tedious. There's no passion in the room at all. But I suppose, you know, nailing down a treaty that is acceptable to be signed by hopefully all nations, particularly the nuclear armed ones, takes time, and it is, I suppose, a pedantic process. But what was happening was there were these side events in other smaller rooms for maybe 30, 40 people, where there were peace activists, survivors, descendants of survivors, representatives from nations around the world, like in the Pacific, that have been affected by radioactive fallout from bomb testing. And this was amazing to go to those sessions and meet a range of extraordinary men and women who were doing such fantastic work. I mean, for example, I heard one woman talking, Japanese, Michie Takeuchi, and she's the granddaughter of the man who was the director of the Hiroshima Red Cross Hospital the day the bomb dropped. She's his granddaughter. He's no longer alive, but he survived the bomb, injured, but carried on doing what he could for, you know, the waves of injured people that came into the hospital, and kept diaries, which Michie subsequently came into her possession. And she's made a film about Setsuko Thurlow, the vow from Hiroshima. So she was talking about her grandfather and the diaries. So it was amazing. So I introduced myself to her afterwards, said, I'm doing this play about, she said, oh, wow, okay, oh, I'm gonna come. So she came to see the play twice. And there were other people very involved in similar activities who also came to see. So we all sort of hooked up and gave each other encouragement and strength. So as I say, this was not a career opportunity for me. It was an incredible sort of coming together of people that are working hard in different ways and in different fields, all for the same end, to try and put an end to these terrible weapons.
That's a wonderful story of connection. And I heard there was a fantastic play in London about the Kyoto Protocol called Kyoto, which came out last year. So maybe this is a future project for you to represent all those wonderful side meetings and connections and stories to make the actual nuclear proliferation meetings a little bit more dynamic. I heard that that's what they did with the Kyoto play as well. I'd love to see that.
Yeah, I think it's been to Broadway as well, or is going to Broadway. That's the Royal Shakespeare Company, so big production. And I had a friend in it, so I went along to see it at Stratford-on-Avon. And it's pretty much, because it's about the climate crisis, but it's pretty much what I saw in the, I mean, as a play, it's made very dynamic and interesting, yeah. But in terms of what's actually going on, it's pretty much what I saw in the conference room for the non-proliferation. There's a lot of arguing in Kyoto about the exact word to use in a sentence. You know, could we say should rather than would? Or, you know, could we say, you know, these sort of various nations who are resisting taking urgent action, you know, are sort of fudging and delaying things by saying, no, that word, we can't accept that word in that sentence. And you sort of think, for goodness sake, you know, the planet is in serious danger. And similarly with the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which sadly, at the end of the 2 weeks, I think I went to one of the final sessions, and they failed to come up with a treaty that everyone could sign. So, you know, all these people have come from all over the world, 200 plus nations, and they haven't actually come up with something. So they've got to have more discussions. They still haven't come up with something that could be signed to the satisfaction of the relevant countries. Yeah.
It was amazing that the Nobel Peace Prize was given last year to the Hidankyo, the Hibakusha survivors group, and all of their amazing work over 80 years trying to promote peace and non-proliferation of nuclear weapons. And so that was a real wonderful tribute for them to get the prize last year, wasn't it?
It really was. Long overdue.
Long overdue.
I mean, that's another reason. One or two people have said to me, you know, why are you doing this play now? One of the main reasons is we've got to keep these stories alive. You know, the Hibakusha, I think the average age is about 86 now. And, you know, they're not going to be around for much longer. It's the same with the Holocaust. You know, they're not going to be around much longer. But we need to keep, and younger people, you know, we performed in schools in the UK. So do you talk much about Hiroshima? I said, oh, I think we did about half an hour on it in history, you know, half an hour. Okay. You could sort of see, well, British schools maybe think now we're going to focus on the war in Europe or whatever. But it was quite shocking to see how many younger people knew very, very little. And as older people die out, as the Hibakusha die out, you know, we have to keep these stories alive. And theater, I mean, Oppenheimer, the film performed to, you know, obviously cinema, you have vast numbers going to see films and awards and all of that. Theater reaches very few people, but why I'm passionate about live theater is you can really affect people because they're in the room with you. So the people watching, for example, Rika enacting the role of the atomic bomb survivor, she's so moving. And they're in the room with her. And when they see her, when they see tears on her face, you know, they're not faked. I mean, she's an actress, you know, with great skill, but it's happening right there in front of them. And I mean, Gloria Steinem, you know, the great academic feminist journalist, still with us, thankfully. She, I heard her on a podcast a couple of years ago, and she was talking about the power of being in the room with people, telling stories in the same room. She said, you know, film telly is fine, books fine, but there's something about being in the same room, sharing stories in the same room. And yeah, as far as books go, there have been many wonderful books written and important books about Hiroshima and academic books, you know, with statistics and this many people died, this many people. And I read a very simple quote somewhere which said, statistics don't bleed. And it's true, you know, you say 100,000, about 100,000 died in Hiroshima. It's hard to imagine what 100,000 really looks like. But if you listen to one story of one survivor, then it, and the details of what they've gone through, then it really brings it home to you, really brings it home. And I think telling stories in the theatre can really affect change. My dream is that I love performing it for whoever comes to see it. One of my dreams is to perform it for politicians and world leaders. I'd love to perform it in the Kremlin and the White House. Fat chance of that happening. Under Obama, possibly. I don't know, but certainly not now.
Fingers crossed for you. My fingers are crossed.
Yeah. And,
but that, you know, that is so important to communicate the message. It's so much more important now. It's like we're at 80 years. It's even more important now.
Yeah.
As we're losing people who firsthand experienced and can tell us firsthand. So yeah. In that way, what you're doing, a theatrical version, that could be a carry-on by next generation, is also wonderful. It's fantastic.
I mean, yeah, I was going to mention Greta Thunberg, who's, you know, been so inspiring in the climate crisis movement. I sort of, my other hope is that there'll be a young person in the audience for The Mistake who maybe doesn't know much about what happened at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, or knows a little bit, but then is inspired to go out and do something, you know, to inspire the younger generation. Also, the other thing that's been very gratifying. So we performed it this last weekend to 400 people, twice, to about 800 people, 400 people a night, in a huge tent, in a field, in about 50 miles north of London, at a festival. And it was not ideal performing conditions. There were no seats, so they were sat on the ground, or they brought their own little portable stools, or there were some people in wheelchairs, some people stood. We had to have radio mics, you know, headsets, because it was a tent. There was no real acoustic comeback. But it went really, really well, amazingly. And an older Japanese woman came up to me afterwards and said, "It's so moving to see 400 British people sitting down to hear a story about Hiroshima." And I thought, wow, that really makes it all worthwhile. That's why I do it. And similarly, bringing it to Japan, I wanted to bring it to Japan to show, as a gift almost to the Japanese audiences, to show that there are Western artists who are completely engaged with this story and utterly empathetic to what happened on those two terrible days. And that, you know, there are Western artists that are really thinking about this, exploring it and trying to create a piece of work that illuminates the horrors of those 2 days in the hope that it will never happen again.
Well, that's a wonderful place to end it, Michael. It's been a wonderful hour talking with you about all your insights about this amazing play. We had a chance to talk a little bit about your other play, Priest's Tale, which I hope to see in Japan sometime too, yeah, in the future. That would be fantastic. We'd love to see that in Hiroshima, where there's so many connections, of course, to his story. Yeah. But I hope the plays go really well in Japan. And I just want to tell you how much we appreciate your work and for carrying on the message and connecting to people in this way and making it really meaningful to the people who watch, and hopefully a greater audience as well.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you very much. Best of luck. And I will put, I will put the links below.
Thank you.
To your crowdfunding, where people can support you, your website, where people can find out more, and upcoming dates also on the website, as well as a link to the trailer so people can watch a little preview. We didn't have time to show that during our talk, but definitely worth checking out and going if you can in Tokyo, Tottori, and Hiroshima. Definitely try to get to one of the performances and see it for yourself. Thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you. Arigato gozaimasu.
Arigato gozaimasu. Thanks, everyone, for joining. Have a great day. Take care.